Hello and welcome to another episode of Small Gold Subscribers Sound Off series. Today we have a returning guest, Vijay Mara, and we're delighted to have him again. And today we're going to talk about currencies, not cryptocurrencies, but the good old-fashioned paper currencies. And Vijay has done a lot of research on that. We're going to talk about currencies, not cryptocurrencies. Got to keep myself from saying cryptocurrencies. Vijay, how are you today?
I'm good. I'm good. Just chilling here and looking forward to this brief chat.
Well, it's good to have you back. What's on your mind before we get into cryptocurrencies? Anything you want to talk about from the last time we spoke?
I think the last time I was on there, we were talking about there was an election coming up here, and everyone was saying how the Labour Party was going to get wiped out and stuff. And I was saying, you know, it looks like it doesn't look like that's going to be the case. And as it turned out, the Labour Party won 50 or more seats rather than losing 50 seats. So that turned out to be quite good because I had a little bet on there. So that was good. And but yeah, we still managed to get a Conservative government. So they're pushing ahead with Brexit and all that. And
are they?
What happens? Well, so far, yeah, it just looks like, you know, it's just playing games. And when you look at the people that are in the government who are negotiating for Brexit, they don't seem to be very into the idea. So who knows what will happen? Yeah, it's supposed to be a 2-year deadline that they gave, you know, before, you know, the UK leaves. But at the moment, it's just kind of like doing some kind of Mexican standoff, I think, with the commission.
Right. So what happens if they don't come to an agreement after 2 years?
Well, they can mutually agree to extend the deadline, or they can just say, yeah, okay, that's it. And then they'll revert to the World Trade Organization rules, which is what most of the rest of the world uses. So I don't see what the problem is if there's no special deal that's made up.
Do you know what the sticking points are? I mean, doesn't the EU want the United Kingdom to pay them?
Yeah. Basically, there's all of this comes down to the fact that in the Lisbon Treaty and Maastricht Treaty that were signed when the UK joined and the other countries joined the EU in the form it exists today, is there were no rules on leaving the EU. Just as in the States, there's no rules on seceding from the US. So all of these issues are basically about how that process goes about. But because there's no rules, the UK isn't actually obliged to, say, give billions of euros or pounds to the EU if they don't want to either. But the EU saying you got to honour your commitments financially and all this stuff, and the UK saying, well, we don't have to do anything if we don't want to. So, you know, the EU's basically given a list of rules saying we're not going to negotiate until you agree to this. UK saying, no, I think... you know, you guys haven't got a leg to stand on because we can just leave if we want to. So it's a bit of a standoff.
Well, it's very interesting because you have these secession movements around the European Union. And you have, what's interesting is in Catalonia, and I know you lived in Spain. Before we get on to currencies, yeah, Maybe you can tell us about this. But in Catalonia, apparently they want to leave Spain, but then the irony to me is they want to become part of the EU. Is that correct?
Yeah, this is the funny thing with Scotland as well here that wanted independence. They were saying, you know, they want to be in the EU, but they haven't clocked on to the fact that the EU relies around the nation state as it exists now, and they delegate from the nation state level downwards. They don't take in other smaller states that secede and stuff, because they'd have to just reapply, which is what the EU has said. And people are really like, oh, the reason they're doing it is to say that we are European, we are not Spanish, or we are not British, we are Scots, and we are Europeans. So it's a kind of way to try and have a kind of solidarity with other people from other countries all across the continent. But obviously, there's a bunch of other issues around being in the EU which go beyond solidarity, and those are mainly around financial concerns, as we know. So, you know, the people, powers that be, they don't want to have all this financial mess to deal with if he decides to leave.
Well, you've spent some time in Spain. Can you talk briefly about the regional differences before we move on to currencies between Catalonia, the rest of Spain, and of course some of the other regional differences that exist in Spain?
Yeah, I can give you a brief like summary. So in Spain, there's five official languages in the constitution. There's Catalan, there's Spanish as we know it, Castellano from the Castellan like region, Madrid and Castilla-La Mancha, I think the region's called. And then there's Valenciano, which is a bit like Catalan. You've got the language from Ibiza, which is the island off Spain. That's a bit like Catalan. You've got Galician, which or Gallego, which is similar to Portuguese. The roots of Portuguese are in there as well, in the northwest of Spain. And in the south, you've got quite distinctive Spanish as well. So there's these different languages in the constitution, but you've also got a completely alien language to Spanish, which is Basque. So in the north of Spain, on the north coast, and around the border with France and going into France. And there's a region called the Basque region, and these people have a completely unique language, which is the closest language to it is from the Caucasus in Georgia or somewhere. And they've been around there for, you know, a good few thousand years in the north of Spain. These people have not a lot to learn about them. Even genetically, they're different. They have a more likely to have a blood type O. And you can tell sometimes from looking at them, you know, you can tell someone is Basque. So it's a diverse range of people with their own languages and their own regional and cultural pride. So you know, you speak to a lot of people that are in Spain, and you ask them about, oh, where are you from? You know, and you say, oh yeah, you know, like say you have a bunch of international people in a room. You're from the States. I'm from the UK, whatever. And you know, someone says, where are you from? They're more likely to say, oh, I'm from Spain. But then, or they might say, oh, I'm from this part of Spain, and we have the best food, and we have this like unique language, and we have this annual celebration, this culture, and they talk more about their region because they're more proud of the part of Spain that they're from, or the area that they're from, rather than the whole national thing, which has only really become popular since Spain started winning in the football, you know, 2008, 2010, and 2012, won the European Championship twice and the World Cup. So that kind of brought them together a bit. But even so, I was in the Basque country in 2010 with a friend of mine during the San Fermin festival in Pamplona, where they, you know, run the bulls in the street and all that. So my best friend's from Pamplona. And we were in a bar, and it was full of Basque people, and we were getting really dirty looks from everyone because we were supporting Spain, and they were playing Germany, because all the Basque people that were in this Basque bar were supporting Germany. And one of our friends there was happened to be German, and they didn't do anything and you know, left us alone. But it was a bit strange to be in Spain and see the people not supporting Spain, and then you know the stories of the you know Catalan people booing the Spanish team, even though it's got Catalan players in there. Because of this. So there's this whole regional thing going on.
Which you have also in Italy as well. I know it's not just north versus south, because these city-states have a history in Italy, Venice, Florence, Naples, those areas, longer than Italy's been a country. Italy's only been a country since what, 1862. So there still are those regional differences. And before we get into currencies, I want to delay it, but do you have the same thing in India?
Yeah, well, you know, India is it wasn't really a unified country. It took the British to make it into one country, but for hundreds of years, you know, the Muslims never conquered the south of India, and the north and the south of India had their own kind of separate development. So it was only the British that managed to unite them. The Muslims only ruled the northern half of India, the Mughals, you know, who created the Taj Mahal and all that. So they have like their own north-south divide there. And then also in the Indian constitution there's 18 or 20 different languages, and then you've got 600 dialects as well that people speak. So I've got, you know, connections, friends, people in India I know, obviously because of my own roots. And you know, they tell me that, you know, when they meet someone from the south, if they're from the north, the both of them would rather speak in English, and obviously English is in the constitution as well as the language. But
Oh,
they would prefer
interesting.
to speak English than to speak Hindi, because Hindi is considered an invader language.
Ah, I see. Well,
So,
from
yeah.
that, let's now move to currencies, because currencies are also a local, regional, and national creation. Now, you've done some studying on the background of currencies and also what's going on with them today. You want to kick that off, that discussion off on what you've been learning about paper currencies?
Yeah, sure. If we go back in time, obviously we know the origins, and maybe should we run into that, or is that like too far back?
Well, give whatever you think to, for
All
our
right.
under
Okay.
our people to understand what's going on, where paper currencies arose
Yeah.
from, and what they're what the what's been happening and what their future might be.
Sure. So the oldest re recorded paper currencies about 1,000 years ago goes back to when Marco Polo went from Italy. He reported on it, what he saw was happening in China. So in China, the emperor would issue these paper notes, and everyone was forced upon death, to use these paper notes as their money, and he would decide how much of this paper money would go into circulation. And the notes would have written on them that if you don't use this currency, or you try to damage it or forge it, you'll be punished, put to death, and your assets will be given to the person who reports this. So that was basically written in Chinese on the notes. It was a way to enforce people to use the notes. But what was interesting was that the currency was controlled centrally by the emperor. So if you were like a trader on the Silk Road and you wanted to go to China and you wanted to buy something, you'd bring your wares either along the Silk Road or by ship, and it would all be presented to the emperor's court. And then the emperor would get his assayers and people that would value everything, and they would say, "Okay, you've got 20 Persian rugs here. My people think it's worth this much." And then they would agree a price, and then give you these paper notes if you're a trader from the West or somewhere. And then you could take these paper notes, and you'd know that anywhere in the Chinese kingdom you could use them to buy stuff to take back with you. So because it was centrally controlled, the emperor could decree how much currency was taken out of circulation, how much was put in circulation. So there was always enough money around to handle the size of the economy. So that was the sort of thing that Marco Polo reported when he came back to Europe.
Now, it's interesting when a lot of people talk about paper currency, they have this distaste in their mouth because of what you said, there's a central issuer, they control the supply. But in a sense, it's also an innovation because it did facilitate trade, did it not?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, if you're a trader and you go to some country and they give you something that's accepted everywhere, whether it's coins, whether it's paper, whether it's shells, who cares? As long as you can get what you want out of that country and take it back and sell it for your gold and silver, which is what they were doing in Europe. So, you wanted to buy some Chinese fans, wares, whatever, pottery, it wouldn't be a problem.
So,
Silk.
then what happened to the paper currencies from there?
They continued using it there, but the idea of paper currency was obviously brought back to Europe, and in Europe at the time, they had been using gold and silver for obviously thousands of years, and people were getting tired of having to like pass around gold and silver to trade with, as it could be quite bulky. So they left the gold and silver with their trusted people, who were blacksmiths. So the blacksmiths give
Goldsmiths, no?
the blacksmiths would work with gold and any other metals.
Ah, okay. So they were blacksmiths, not necessarily goldsmiths.
They became goldsmiths after they specialized more, but the
Okay, thank you.
blacksmith was the go-to person in the local village or town or wherever that you'd go, and anything metal. So you'd go to your blacksmith and you'd say, look after this gold and whatever. I'll get this receipt from you. And that's how the paper money came about in the West, was from dealing with the blacksmiths. And over time, obviously, we know what happened. The blacksmiths realized they can give out more receipts than they had gold to cover for, and then
Right.
they collude together and have associations. So if one guy was short, another guy from the group would help the other one out. So then they kind of had a kind of community. The blacksmiths had their own communities, and they gradually exerted more and more influence and power because they would control the supply of these gold and silver notes. So that enabled them to increase their individual wealth and gain titles and move up the social scale.
Now, these are people that are not governments. These are private blacksmiths become goldsmiths that are gaining power through, in a sense, fractional reserve, not necessarily banking, but smithing, I suppose.
That's right. And the people that were in power before them, the kings and so on, they didn't realize that they could just do as the Chinese emperor did and give out bits of paper and force everyone to use the paper.
And when did that come about? When did the Europeans catch on to that, that a government could do the same as these private goldsmiths were doing?
I can't say for sure, but I know that the, I think it was the Swedish central bank was the first central bank that issued paper notes. And that was, I think, early 1600s.
1600s, yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah. And there was John Locke, who did a massive experiment in France with mass producing paper money, but that was backed by the land. So
the land in America, correct?
Yeah, sorry?
That was the land in America. He was issuing certificates of like the Louisiana area. It was early. Was that the late 1700s, early 1800s? Where Locke...
Yeah, something like that, yeah. So, but John Locke, I think it's John Locke or John Law. He was originally...
John Locke is a philosopher.
All right, yeah, it was John Law, I think.
Law is the guy in The Extraordinary Delusions, that was the book on bubbles.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so he was a bit of a gambler, and he had some good ideas, and one of them was... to escape to France when his debts were after him, and he convinced the King of France at the time, I think it was, to back their currency by the land. So they were giving out all this currency paper money, and they're saying, you know, if you can redeem it with land, and obviously that collapsed after a few years of early success.
So what's interesting is it reminds me that collapsed. And yet the schemes, they continue. And now we even see it with digitization of assets. It's really nothing new other than the form, because when you digitize assets, it's no different than issuing paper receipts off of assets. Isn't that correct?
Yeah. At the end of the day, if your currency is backed by something or not, it doesn't really matter if people are passing around bits of paper and stuff, because you never get to see it or nothing gets proven. So then it's always open to fraud, unless there's some kind of independent way of making sure that there's nothing of the sort going on. In a way, you could say that's a bit like gold money, in that they have regular audits, don't they? Independent audits and so on, to prove that they do have the gold in their vaults and so on.
Sure, but even with gold money, you could foresee a circumstance where the auditors could be paid off. I'm not suggesting this is the case, but you never really know. You don't see it. Even if you do see the gold, you don't know whether they own it or not. So it all relies on third party
trust.
And trust, exactly.
Yes.
So where are we now with currencies?
Well, there's a lot of talk about the war on cash, and people are saying that, you know, we're all going to head towards having this totalitarian system where the end game is everyone will be microchipped, and they will have to be using RFID and some really like out there stuff, which is not altogether delusional, because this is some of the things that has been coming out of these authorities like the World Economic Forum and so on. You know, this is the direction that they are pushing. And if you look at the papers that are published by these institutions and organizations like the BIS and so on. But cash isn't going away. That's the thing. The cash usage is pretty high in Germany, where they never really trust having everything done electronically. They're very much into privacy. Cash usage is high in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. I think in the UK, it's still pretty high. But it's being usage of cash is being diminished over time. There's regular reports and stats that come out from central banks and other organizations showing that the usage is dropping. But cash is always going to be around, because it's so useful and handy. You know, just need to look at, you know, what's happened in These disaster zones like Haiti, or if you look at what's happened in Puerto Rico, your Bitcoin isn't going to work if you've got no electricity, and neither is your cash machine, where your cash card machine, your cash card won't work either. So
So
yeah, it's
you don't think that there will be an elimination of cash totally. You think they will always keep it in reserve, at least for emergencies. Is that what you're saying? Or
yeah.
you're saying they'll keep it for day to day? Because I know in some of the areas what they've done in the EU is they've actually made it illegal certain cash transactions over certain amounts.
Yeah, that's right. In France, I think it's over 1,000 euros, and in Spain, I think it's the same. And they're saying, yeah, if as long as the amount is below a certain range, that it's okay to use cash. But there's been a lot of pushback on that. I think the EU or EU's own study, I think it was the EU or the ECB, had a study, and it showed that the vast majority of the people were against this. But whether or not the authorities act on that is another thing
Sure.
altogether.
But what's going to happen though? There are some countries, it appears, that are trying to move towards cashless. And I would think of China, India, and Sweden. Are they not? I mean, I can see maybe the whole world isn't going towards cashless. And you mentioned Germany and Switzerland, and they have cash traditions. They value their privacy. But are other cultures or governments trying to push this cashless society where they will eliminate cash?
Yeah, well, you can see the approaches that are there, and they both depend on a society which has a high trust level in their institutions. So, if you look at the demonetization within Sweden, for example, nobody talks about Sweden. The minimum amount of cash that you can use for a transaction is 1 krona, which is about 10 cents.
Okay.
So, anything that you buy in cash in Sweden below that amount is going to get rounded. So basically, if you're poor, you get screwed if you don't pay electronically. So basically, that's been a big push to get people to use their cards for payment. They've also made it very cheap, or effectively, you don't pay very much to use a card to buy something. So if you're buying a coffee and a donut from a store, it might only be the equivalent of a dollar or two, but you'd use your card for that. So they've made it easy as well to use your card. And but their way of demonetization has been to reduce the small currency, to force people that don't have much money to use their electronic means, rather than reduce the big denominations.
And then what's happening in India? Because India underwent an overnight demonetization of those rupee notes. Do they
Yeah, so
trust in their government to do that type of thing and say, okay, now we're all going to go digital?
they've gone the opposite way. They've reduced the big notes rather than the small currency. So both countries are being used in a way as a kind of test by central banks to see what the reaction is. That's how I look at it. Central banks and governments, they're both being used. Like, okay, if you get rid of small change, what will happen? That's Sweden. If you get rid of big notes, what will happen? That's in India. But obviously, in India, it was a bit different because they didn't withdraw them completely from circulation. They merely replaced them and added a new note to replace another, because it was 500s and 1,000s, didn't they? They replaced with 500s and 2,000 notes, I think it was. So yeah, but both of these countries, they have a high trust in government, and they trust their authorities. So there hasn't been much of a backlash against any of this. But there's clearly been problems, as we've seen reported in a lot of the alternative media, at least, where the Acting Man website, there was a lot of articles there about
Well,
it.
what's interesting, when I first saw the demonetization of the rupee, my immediate reaction was outrage. I thought, how can a government just pull the money out of circulation that you were counting on having and now put you through the inconvenience of having to go and turn those notes in, even if you could find a bank that was open or have to wait in line to do this? And I thought the reaction in India would be equally outraged. And I started getting comments from people in India saying this was necessary. You don't know what you're talking about. Have you ever been to India? And I didn't realize that the reaction wasn't as negative as I would have imagined it. And then I started thinking, what would happen in America if it happened? And I'm starting to realize, other than the people who are really paying attention to this and are concerned about the downsides of cashless society, I think in America, a lot of people would just say, well, I use my card all the time anyway. And they might not even bat an eye. Is that perhaps how all people look at this?
Yeah, it could be so, but when that happened, it reminded me of a story. If I may digress a little bit.
Your show.
Okay, so there was a guy who was known as he's known as the currency king, basically. Jiori is his name. His family, his father and grandfather, they had a printing business in Italy. They emigrated to Switzerland, and they started a company printing, creating machines to print six color process money, which is what all of our banknotes are based on now. Machines by this guy called Jiori. So he was in India about 15, 16 years ago, and he got kidnapped. Not him directly kidnapped, but hijacked. His plane got hijacked when he was on his way back to Switzerland, I think. And while the plane was hijacked, nobody in the world press, or it was this wasn't really let out that this currency king was on the plane. And Jiori, he was at the time designing new versions of the US dollar, ruble, German mark, and the new European Union currencies for the new unified euro. And so the Swiss negotiated with the Indian government and the terrorists, and they managed to secure the safe release of everybody and him. And this guy, he's so secretive, Mr. Jiori, he doesn't have any publicity of any kind. Nobody's got his photograph, and secret is guaranteed under Swiss law. And while he was in this hijack situation, he said about the people, the other passengers, he said, this I quote this, yeah, the week-long ordeal had an unexpected impact on the currency tycoon. What I experienced on the plane has changed me forever, said Jury. I don't know what it is, Hinduism, the so-called fatalism of Indians. But the way the passengers stayed so calm throughout, even the children, was exemplary. I told myself if the plane had been full of Italians or French, it would have been very different. So when I read that piece on him, I thought maybe he had a word with the Indian government and said the people are going to be fine when you do this demonetization, because he'd obviously seen a crisis situation and seen how the people react so calmly.
Yeah, I mean, the West, there were some pictures where you saw there was some trouble in the line, and but overall, it seems not that I don't think that the economy wasn't harmed by the demonetization, but it did not have, it doesn't seem, these are from the reports I've read, to have been a unmitigated disaster, which I would have thought even trying that. I wouldn't even consider trying overnight to say, okay, you've got 2 days to turn the cash in that you have. After that, it becomes absolutely worthless.
Yeah.
So he must have known the tenor or the of the Indian people that they would put up with it, I suppose. Or actually, not just put up with it, support it.
Absolutely. I think they definitely must have had some idea that this is how the people are gonna act. Maybe it could be that the mainstream media was doing a good job in selling the whole concept of the reason they're doing it is to fight corruption and terrorism and all this kind of stuff. Like one person I know told me, there's been no terrorist attacks since in India since they demonetized. I don't know if that's true or not, but they say it was because there was forged notes coming in from Pakistan and stuff.
Right.
So who
So
knows?
you can get people on the nationalistic bent to support whatever the government does. So where do you see the future of paper currencies?
Well, the way that the future of paper currency is going, it's all turning plastic. I think about 3% of the world's currency supply at the moment is plastic, or polymer, as they call it. But
Can you give some examples of plastic currency? We're not talking about credit cards. You're talking about actual notes or plastic.
Yeah, well, there's 172 billion banknotes issued yearly across the globe. That's from De La Rue, who's one of the two major players in currency production. De La Rue is a British company who's been doing it since the Empire days, and their main competitor, by the way, is a German company called Giesecke and Devrient, and between the two of them, they've kind of split up the whole currency market. So they kind of lead the way in currency innovation, and there's a few other companies that are out there that are smaller, but those are the two main ones. And these polymer notes, they're used in a few countries now. The UK had their first one, I think it was last year or the year before. We had the £5 note made of plastic, and then this year, right now, we're having a £10 note introduced made of plastic. Canada's has them, and Australia was first, I think, first major country to have plastic notes.
What's the purpose and advantage of a plastic note?
Well, plastic notes, from what I've studied, they actually last longer than paper notes to begin with, so that's a cost saving. But I've also read that they're more likely to pass on disease.
Well, you
I
know,
don't.
it's interesting. I could see how the bacteria could reside on the plastic, but a lot of people know this, but silver is antibacterial. So when you have silver coins in copper, that actually reduces the transmitting of disease when you have silver coinage.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Silver has been used for thousands of years as a medical aid. Interestingly, about passing disease with notes was about, I think, 14 or so years ago, when they had the first SARS outbreak in China. They actually withdrew loads of cash because they were afraid, the authorities in China were afraid that the disease would spread from passing money around.
No, I'd heard that before. I also heard that a certain percentage of bills in the United States, especially during the 80s when you had the cocaine epidemic, had more than just traces of cocaine in the fibers of the notes.
What I found out about that was most likely it wasn't that every single note was being used to snort cocaine, but it was coming from the machines having spread around the dust. It was more like
If you've
from
seen the
that.
movie Scarface, they have the where they're cutting the cocaine in one room, and in the other room they're flipping the bills to count them. It's very interesting. So, do you think that if we do have currency, and if you think about this, they're trying to eliminate the coins more for the same reason they are harder to carry around and they want to move over to currency. And the coins themselves today don't represent a monetary value. Other than the penny, which I think is worth, because it doesn't have any copper in it, a penny is worth, even today with the zinc that's in it, is worth about a penny. The nickel is worth about a nickel because of the copper and nickel composition. But after that, the dime and quarter and the dollar bill, the dollar coin that they have, are not worth the metal value. So they can save money by, I know they're trying to eliminate those lower size coins just like they did in Sweden. Do you think we're going to move entirely to, if we're going to have currency that'll be non-coin related, or do you think there'll still be room for coins in some form and paper currencies or plastic currencies?
I think that there's always going to be coins because people have an emotional attachment to coins. Even like for example, with children, you offer them a note, a couple of notes, or dollar bills or whatever, or you offer them a bunch of coins. They're going to take the bunch of coins because even if it's worth considerably less. So I think like to wean people off this emotional attachment is going to be very hard. I think what's more likely to happen is like we discussed earlier, where the value of transactions that can be carried out will be reduced in cash. So we'll use small change for small transactions.
All right. Any other thoughts on the future of paper and plastic and metal currencies before we sign off?
This jewelry fella that I mentioned,
He's got a website and he talks about digital currency there. It's robertogioricompany.com, the website. And this is quite interesting because I haven't seen any reports of this. I've just kind of found out myself, but I'll read from you from the website. Spotlight, creating digital money, which is legal tender. As currency moves from conventional banknotes to digital forms of payment, the Roberto Giori Company is working on projects with central banks and governments around the world to deliver solutions for enhanced payment systems. And then it continues, around 200 payment systems, mobile payment systems have been developed in the last 10 years. None of these is digital money issued by a central bank as legal tender. None of these systems can be converted into, can convert printed banknotes into digital money or vice versa. Our platform has been designed to add a global international standard for reliable, secure operations in one single system within a regulatory and supervisory framework. Our platform is a standard which can be used by both mobile network operators and financial institutions to manage the flow of digital financial transactions more effectively anywhere in the world. So reading through that, it sounds like there's some plan still for linking cash with the digital world. And I was thinking like, well, what's the detail? I couldn't find anything more on that, but I came across a tweet from someone in the country, Paraguay. And this was quite interesting. It's in Spanish and I've kind of had to translate it. My Spanish isn't great, but having lived, I could more or less translate it. And what this person I found who tweeted about a proposition from this Giori company about digital currency notes was quite interesting. What they say is there were like five advantages that were claimed. It gives better security to the person because it's rapid tracking if stolen. So obviously these digital banknotes that are planned, remember there was a few articles not so long ago about the $100 bill in Australia is going to have some kind of microchip in it. Maybe this is related to that, some kind of RFID thing. So it says that, yeah, they'll have better security. They're saying every algorithm is unique and every transaction is realized with digital notes and controlled in real time. So that indicates that when you pay with this digital cash, there could be something, some kind of scanner or something in your, or RFID based scanner when you pay for something in the cash register.
It sounds like this guy, he's trying to stay relevant, just like Blockbuster and Netflix with the DVDs, giving you the option to have a DVD and the digital download. Is that what he's trying to do? He's trying to stay in the he's trying to move digitally with his legacy business.
It could be that, but he sold off, I think he sold off the company some years ago. So this is a kind of another angle or project he's going on. So it could be that, yeah, he's definitely trying to stay relevant. But it's interesting to note that if this is the way things are going with everything being tracked and traced, that this is what's being planned.
So basically you're saying is that right now the advantage to currency, physical currency, is that it can't be tracked and traced, but this type could be.
Yeah, it says, you know, the third point out of the five was if a forgery is attempted, it can automatically notify the central bank. It doesn't say how, which can remove the note from circulation or create new money with the same denomination.
I see. So what basically you give the people the appearance and the security of the appearance that you have cash and that you still have something in your hand when really you're still being tracked and traced.
Yeah, exactly. And it says the notes activate from the moment they leave the central bank. And the final point was that they say it's a great cost savings because they can remotely cancel the notes at any time. So I suppose if you try and pay with something and you go to the cash register and it'll say this note's withdrawn.
Ah, okay. Like, well, thank you very much, Vijay, for all the insights on currency and European, and we hope to have you back soon. Now, tell our listeners where they could reach you and your fine work.
All right. I used to blog for many years, and I've got a blog that I've started writing again. I wrote quite a lot about currency on my last blog post, so you can see my blog post at urunu.com. That's urunu.com. So that's where you can see my blog. And if you want to follow me on Twitter, I tweet a lot about financial stuff.
That's my Twitter handle is Vigino. That's Vijinho.
All right. Well, we'll put the links below this YouTube, this BitChute, and this VidMe. And thank you for joining us again, Vijay.
Thanks a lot, Luce. It's been a pleasure.